I have good news for you today. Who could use a little good news? If you've got a Bible, turn to the book of Genesis, chapter 50. Genesis isn't hard to find. It's the first book in your Bible. And in chapter 50 is one of the most amazing sermons in the whole Bible. And so Genesis is the story of the beginnings. That's kind of where it got its name. And it's the story of creation, and then Noah, and then the patriarchs. They have Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and all of their stories. And then Jacob had 12 sons, after whom all of the tribes were named. And the second to youngest name was Joseph. And so the whole last part of the book of Genesis is about Joseph. And so whenever I hear brother stories, especially in Genesis, I always remember it's no coincidence that their names are the 12 tribes of Israel. It's because their stories are actually symbolic stories about the relationship between the tribes. So I'm always looking for the story behind the story. Same with Cain and Abel. Cain got jealous of his brother Abel and killed him at the beginning of the story, just like the northern kingdom was jealous of the southern kingdom, Judah, and rose up against them. This is a similar story. And so the Joseph story in Genesis, it's kind of a bookend. And so the beginning and the end are the story of the conflict between Joseph and his older brothers. There's a whole middle section for several chapters that's later. It's very Persian. And we know this just because of how it talks. It's the whole story of Joseph in Potiphar's house and Joseph in jail and Joseph being the prime minister of Egypt and him and Pharaoh. And we know this because there's a lot of money mentioned in there, and the Persians invented money. Before that, nobody used money in the world. And so, but the bookend is the part that I want to talk about today. Do you remember the beginning of Joseph's story, how he ended up in Egypt in the first place? He was a young man. His father, Jacob, who God changed his name to Israel, which is where the nation got its name. He made him a multicolored coat because he was his favorite, because he was the child of his youth. This is all a story, by the way, of how Judah got favored when the northern 10 tribes got conquered. So the northern 10 tribes, the older brothers are the northern, are Israel, and Joseph now stands in for Judah. He's the favorite child, and his brothers hated him. And then he tells them this dream. You remember the dream? They're out there working in the field together, and he's the youngest, right? He's already wearing his multicolored coat that put a target on him. I don't know whether it was striped, but I kind of think his coat had target painted on the front of it. It was multicolored target. But he tells them this dream. Oh, brothers, I had a dream. And in my dream, we were all gathering in sheaves in the field, and my sheave rose up higher than yours. And then all of your sheaves bowed down and worshiped me. And the Bible says, and so they hated him all the more. And then he tells him another dream. He wasn't real quick. He didn't pick up. And then he says, oh, brothers, I had another great dream. There was the sun and the moon and 11 other stars. So like his mother and father and all of his older brothers, right? And I was standing there in the midst of them, and they all gathered around me and bowed down and worshiped me. And he's going, who are you talking to? At that one, even his father, who loved him, rebuked him. Said, what are you talking about? And are we all going to be worshiping you? And then it says his father kept it in his head. And so his brothers did what most of us would do. They beat him up and threw him in a hole. If I was his older brother, I would have treated him exactly the same way, wouldn't you? This is the point of the story. By the way, it's a Judean story, so you're supposed to put yourself in Joseph's shoes. And anyway, he gets beat up, and his older brother, one of them is Reuben, which was the tribe that was over in Moab, sticks up for him, said, let's not kill him. Let's sell him into slavery. And then his other brother, Judah, stands up for him and saves his life. And he gets sold into slavery, and they take the coat back to their father, and they say, oh, a wild animal ate him. And then that's the end. And then Jacob grieves for him. And then there's a bunch of chapters of other stuff that happened in Joseph's life. And at the end of Genesis, we get the conclusion of the story. And it's one of the greatest sermons. I almost feel guilty preaching this story because it's already a sermon. It's like preaching about a sermon, right? It's like trying to sing a Frank Sinatra song. You're just going to mess it up. It's not going to get better. But if you ever read the Bible and feel really smart because you notice that there's a moral to the story, well, you are very smart. But the reason you see it is because there was a moral to the story. We're supposed to read it. It's not a documentary. It's a sermon. And so read this story with me, would you? And I'm going to read it from the MCV, which is the Mike Cook version. And so it goes like this. So you can read it from your screen. Your Bible is not too far different, but there's just a couple of tweaks. It says, when Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, what if Joseph hates us and pays us back all the evil we did to him? And so that word hate is like in the early part of the story when his brothers hated him. And he says, what if he pays us back? NIV says, what if he pays us back for all the evil? No, what if he does evil to us like we did evil to him? So just for you to know, in Hebrew, the word evil is ra. It's a very core basic word. It's what Jesus prayed when he said, deliver us from evil. Sometimes in English, we think of that as like wickedness or like the devil or like witchcraft or something like that. Evil is just means bad. So it can mean harm or ill or wrongdoing. What if he does wrong to us like we did wrong to him? And so they entreated Joseph, because Joseph was in charge of their food at this point, saying, your father commanded us before he died. This is what you shall say to Joseph. I ask you, forgive now the transgression of your brothers and their sin for the evil they did to you. You know, there's no place in the Bible where it says that Jacob said this to his sons. In fact, I couldn't find any place in this story where his father ever learned what they did to him till the day he died. So this is, not only had they wronged him, but now they're lying about what their father said. He said, oh, did we forget to tell you? Dad said you're supposed to forgive us. Just before he died, he said it on his deathbed. Please forgive my sons. But he uses this phrase that I love. Forgive now the transgression. Say, forgive now the transgression. There's this phrase, sa na pesha. So sa means, there's different words for forgive. It means to lift off, remove it, like it's a burden that we need it lifted off. Na means now. So it's like a petition. It's like the word hosanna means save us now. And then the last one is pesha, which is a transgression. It means a wrongdoing or a trespass. So there's different words for sin. This isn't one he's not saying forgive us for the misunderstanding. You ever had somebody give you a non-apology like that? I'm so sorry that you were offended. Which owns nothing, blames it all on you, right? Because you were the one that took it wrong. That's not an apology. I'm sorry if you were offended. It's not an apology. It's actually a further insult, right? A transgression is something you did. Not something somebody said you did. It's something that you actually did. It's a wrongdoing. No, you did do that. It wasn't, they didn't misunderstand. You hurt them. You spoke ill to them. You ripped them off. You cheated on them. You went back on your word. You did something wrong to somebody. And don't raise your hand. We've all done something wrong to somebody. Not only that, but have we not all had something wrong done to us as well? All of us have. So this is a story we can all relate to. It's so great. This is like the story of the prodigal son. It is so good and so easy to understand. And he says, forgive the transgression and their sin, which is a word that means the guilt because of our transgression, and the evil is the harm that was done because of our transgression. And so then they say to him, now this is their own voice, and so please forgive now the transgression. Sana pesha. Forgive now the transgression of the servants of the God of your father. They're really laying it on thick and tapping into Joseph's love for his father. Forgive now the God of your father. We're his servants. And Joseph wept at their words to him. And his brothers also fell down on their faces and said, behold, we are your servants. This is a story about reconciliation between these brothers. But all throughout this story, we hear over and over again about Joseph even needing to take a break, go to the other room, and weep. Because God wasn't just restoring these brothers to their little brother, but he was restoring him to them. And there's a backstory of this. This is told in the Judean kingdom about how God wanted to reconcile all 12 tribes after they'd been at enmity for so long. In verse 19, Joseph says, and one of the most instructive responses in the entire Bible, said, but Joseph said to them, would you read it with me? Do not fear. Am I in the place of God? But as for you, the evil you devised against me, God devised it for good, in order to bring about a day such as this to save many lives. And there's a kind of a tag in there to save many lives. In the big story, kind of refers to him being the distributor of the food during the famine. But I think it's even more than that, that God intended this for just such a day as this, a day that we'd finally be reconciled, that things would finally be made right between you and me. And so it's kind of a universal story about bringing reconciliation where there used to be hurt. And listen to his response. So important. Am I in the place of God? In Hebrew, it can also be translated, I am in the place of God. But every English translation says it as a question because it makes more sense. Who am I to be in the place of God and to be your judge? And then he says, and the evil that you did to me, the harm that you did to me, even though it doesn't excuse it, doesn't make it right, doesn't undo it, but God even took the evil that you did to me to do something good. And he has used it in my life and he's used it in other people's lives. There's a song that we sing in worship team, but they forgot to sing it this morning. And it's, you take what the enemy meant for evil and you turned it for good. You turned it around for good. And so this was his response. And friends, we are supposed to take Joseph's example and say, this is how you respond to something that's been done wrong. Not only first, that we're not supposed to take God's place and be the judge, but also to recognize the freedom that there is in letting something go and forgiving somebody, even when they don't deserve it. And then the last verse is, and so then do not fear. I will provide for you and your children. And then it says, and he comforted them and he spoke to their hearts. So the last thing he did is he spoke and restored the relationship there. Friends, I got to tell you, is it surprising to anybody that this is in the Old Testament, so-called? I call it the Hebrew Bible because I don't think there's anything old about it. The New Testament's old too. But this is 700 years before Jesus was born. Some people think that the Hebrew Bible is all about judgment and eye for an eye and all of this. And we only learn about forgiveness when the gospel comes along. But it's not so. God has been preaching to us from the very beginning of the story the importance of being reconciled and not only to be forgiven, but also to extend forgiveness, and that there's healing for everybody involved when we discovered that we forgive because Jesus forgave us. Are you with me so far? I told you this. I should have probably just read the story and closed the Bible and said, let's just pray now, because it preaches itself. What am I going to add to that story? It's already brilliant. But here I go. Let me just lead us in a meditation, right? Let's just think about it a little bit and rehearse some of the things that Joseph said. And so his brothers, first they say, what if he pays us back all the evil we did to him? So what if he does evil to us just like we did evil to him? Which is the most automatic, natural thing you never have to teach your kids when they get hit to hit back. Or if they steal something, to steal it back. You don't have to teach your kids retribution. It's just natural. And friends, and I have to say too, there is a point in the time for justice to take place. But he's talking about this restoration that only comes when we practice one of the things that God has been practicing on us since we were born. It's a little word called forbearance. You know what forbearance is? It's to bear forth. It means to carry it. It means to take it on the chin. It means to turn the other cheek. It means to overlook an offense. It means to not give somebody what they deserve. They deserve for you to go and get even. But you have the grace and the maturity and the mercy in your heart to not give them as they deserve. How many know, parents, you have to practice this on a regular basis. There's a point in time for discipline. Molly and I've tried over the years, although we've probably messed it up a bunch of times like you have, but we try only to discipline on the schedule of the kids, like what they need. I don't discipline because I need to get something off my chest. If it was, they'd be disciplined a lot. But I try for the most part to forbear until it's time where this could be an instructional moment and for their sake. And if we just carry around in our hearts the need to get even all the time, have you ever gotten even before? You know, you say, well, it might feel good for a second for the flesh, but have you ever noticed it's never quite as satisfying as you think it's going to be? It's never quite what you built it up to be. All of these years you thought, well, if I just hold this unforgiveness towards them, they're going to feel terrible their whole life. And friends, I had news for you. They aren't thinking about you at all. They have forgotten about what they did to you, or they didn't even realize they did it to you. And so the only person you've been weighing down is you. And so getting even is not as satisfying as you think. Romans 12 says this, and I got to think the Apostle Paul was even quoting the Joseph story when he said this. He said, don't repay anyone evil for evil. Be careful to do what is right in the eyes of everyone. If it is possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. I am so grateful. I've known that verse for most of my life. And I am so grateful for Paul for throwing that one line in there. Aren't you? So far as it depends on you. Because how many know it's not always possible to live at peace with everybody, or at least for them to be peaceful with you? I have peace. I said, you're a pastor, Pastor Mike. Nobody has anything against you. Oh, please. There's a lot of people that have things against me. And some of it is because of stuff that I did, and some of it I didn't do it, but they're still mad. And some of them I've been able to reconcile, and some of them I probably never will. You just can't. You cannot be at peace with everyone because they have a free will too. How many are with me so far? So Paul says, but so far as it depends on you, don't repay evil with evil, but do your very best to live at peace with everybody. You know, years ago there was a curriculum that probably still is around. We never really did it in our church, but churches around did it. And there's some wisdom in it. It was kind of about finding healing in our life and going back and touching on maybe some unhealed wounds from our childhood or from our past. The thing that gave me pause about it is in a lot of cases, it was about adult children going back and digging up old things that their parents had done when they were little kids. And I said, what are they going to do about it? You can't go back and reparent you. They already did it. And by the way, if you're still offended at how your parents raised you, you should have seen how their parents did it. It was 10 times worse. It was bad how they, and you should have seen how their parents did it to them. And so I just never, sometimes, maybe every once in a while, there's a time to go back and have a conversation. But I said, what good is it just to dig up past things? And sometimes what we do is just create a fresh wound where that wound had turned into a scar years ago. And so why re-wound it once again? I'm saying maybe you have a different opinion about it. But there is a time and a place for just letting the past be buried in the past. And so without needing to go back, that's called forbearance. And it's what Joseph did. Did you notice there's never a part in the story where he went down and chased his brothers, even when he was in power? He didn't. He just let it go. He didn't let it go. He put it into the hands of the Lord. So this is the important part. Do not fear. He says, am I in the place of God? Is it my job to make everything right in the world? Is that interesting? Anybody ever told you this? You do not have to right every wrong in the world. You don't. You're not in the place of God. It's not my job either. Every once in a while, people will mess up or they'll be in sin. And I've had people that are kind of more militaristic about how the church is supposed to treat sin. They say, Pastor Mike, aren't you going to do something? I said, what do you want me to do? I mean, I talked to them about it. Yeah, but they're sinning. I said, they already know that. They're choosing to do it. But are you just going to let them get away with it? I said, no. Let me tell you something. Nobody ever gets away with it. Nobody ever gets away with it. Not you, not me. We all have a God that's watching after us. And he's in charge of our life from beginning to end. We're all going to stand before him someday. Anybody with me so far? And so Romans 12, the next verse, which Romans 12, by the way, is a great one to memorize because the whole thing is just chock full. It's one of my favorites to give to teenagers for devotional time. Because every word is just dripping with meaning and life wisdom. He says, do not take revenge, my dear friends, but leave room for God's wrath, for it is written, it is mine to avenge. I will repay, says the Lord. Now he does quote from the Old Testament. He's saying, you know, I gotta just give it to the Lord. I gotta say, Lord, that person doesn't work for me. James says, who am I to judge someone else's servant? To his own master he will rise and fall. So I just have to decide, you and me, are we going to step into God's shoes? I know this, friends, I mentioned it a minute ago. Someday, this life on this earth is going to be over, and we're going to go stand before the throne of God and answer for the things that we've done in this life. And I can promise you one thing. When you look up on that throne, it's not going to be me sitting there. And it's not going to be you. It's going to be God Almighty, and he doesn't miss anything. He knows it all. That's why if you've got a hidden sin today or something that you thought you got away with, you need to get with the Lord and make it right. There is a time and a place, too, for making retribution. This is the other side of the coin. Anybody that's been through the 12 steps of recovery know that making amends is important. It's important when we can. And once again, you can't always. Sometimes the best gift you can give somebody is just to move on in peace and let it go. But every once in a while, there is maybe something we can do to go back and make amends. Or as one of my favorite therapists of one of my kids who was Hispanic, she was one of my favorites. She had a heavy accent. She'd always look my son in the eye and she says, "Listen, you must make amendments." So Molly and I don't say amends anymore. We always call them amendments. You must make amendments in life. How many are with me so far? All right, I'll move on. The second thing is the power of forgiveness. Now, forgiveness is a little different than forbearance. Forbearance is turning the other cheek and not having to get even. Forgiveness is letting it go. Forgiveness is, you remember what he said? Sana. Let it go now. Sana pesha. Let now, lift off the transgression off of my shoulders. And friends, what I found about that is, anytime I have ever forgiven somebody, it's such a strange thing, but you know it to be true because you've lived long enough to know the power of forgiveness. Am I wrong? You know how important forgiveness is. And it's an old cliche, but somebody once said that forgiveness is like turning the key to unlock a prison door, to set a prisoner free, and then suddenly realizing that you were the prisoner the whole time. It's ironic, isn't it? We think we're putting a burden on that person. It's like walking around, somebody does something to me, and I said, "Oh, man," and I hold a grudge. It's like I pick up a big rock, and I put it in my backpack, and I start carrying it around, and then I get another rock, and I put it in there, and I'm walking around. After a little while in life, I've got a giant sack of rocks on my back, and it's not bothering anybody else but me. It's my burden. I'm the only one that can carry it, and I'm the only one that can let it go. So forgiveness isn't just about restoring somebody else, but forgiveness. And notice, the one that cried the hardest in this scene was Joseph, because he had been carrying his whole life what his brothers had done to him, the betrayal. And now when they finally came to him, he just bawled because it released something in him. So in Romans 13:8, Paul says this: "Let no debt remain outstanding except the continuing debt to love one another. For he who loves his fellow man has fulfilled the law." Don't you love Romans? Said, don't let any debt. I think the word is physically like a debt, like don't owe anybody money. But Paul uses that word because it can mean both things. When Jesus says in the Lord's Prayer, do you remember? "Forgive us our debts as" what? "As we forgive our debtors." To let it go. And so how do I know that I've forgiven? And it's not just because I say I forgive you. How many know that forgiveness is more than words? Even though the words are important. But forgiveness means I get to the point where I'm still not waiting for you to pay me back. You don't owe me anything. I know I've forgiven when I honestly in my heart can think about that person and I can think, they don't owe me anything. I'm not waiting for the apology. I'm not waiting for the payback. I've let it go. I've just kind of released it into the hands of the Lord. And that's when I know I've forgiven. And friends, have you discovered how much freedom there is? Not just for the other people, but freedom in you to finally get set free from that resentment. Unforgiveness is a burden that only you carry. And the last thing is this, is God can set us free even before we have an apology. How many know that that's true? If you're waiting for it to come back around, friends, you're going to be waiting for something. Oh, can I just tell you, years ago when I first came here, there had been a church split in another church. And some of the people had ended up in this church, and it had been a couple years already. And the pastor would call me on a regular basis, like once a week, and say, "When are we going to get together and have this?" He called it like the truth and reconciliation, which is important. "When are we going to have this meeting?" And I would talk to all of the people that were there and went through it, and they all said, "No, I don't want to have that meeting. We already dealt with it. It's fine. It's in the past." And I kept telling him that, but he was insistent. I called my supervisor, Tom Ferguson. I said, Tom, what am I supposed to do? And he says, don't do it. He said, why not? Because I'm going to tell you what's going to happen. You're going to get together all those people, and they're going to bring up all of their dirty laundry again, and they're all going to get mad at each other again. And at the end of it, that pastor's still not going to be satisfied. Because he has in his mind a fantasy about what reconciliation looks like. He has a fantasy. You might be carrying a fantasy like that about somebody in your life. Man, if they would just come and apologize, the clouds would part, the rainbow would come out, everybody would sing kumbaya. It would be even better than if it never happened in the first place. And friends, I have to tell you, in my life, that has happened maybe 2% of the time. I can't tell you that there hasn't been. I've had kumbaya moments like that. It's kind of pretty cool. But I've had other times too, where the answer was, learning how to make friendship or learning how to extend grace to somebody without everything being all perfect at the end of it. How many are with me so far? Man, it's a kind of a tough word. I told you, I'm not preaching any of this. All I'm doing is preaching the... You heard it in the story of Joseph, didn't you? At the end of the day, they didn't undo anything. And Joseph wasn't waiting. He said, am I in the place of God? And here was this great attitude. God meant it for, you meant it for my harm, but God meant it for my good. He even took that thing that was bad and turned it around. Colossians 3:13 says, bear with each other. That's forbearance, by the way. And forgive one another. That's forgiveness. If any of you has a grievance against someone, forgive as the Lord forgave you. That's something. Forgive as the Lord forgave you. It's one of the most important stories in the Bible. That guy that owed $5. First, no, he owed $5 million in the story. It's supposed to be an astronomical number. He owed $5 million, and his boss came and said, no, I'm going to forgive you. And then he had his buddy that owed him $5, and he had him beat up and thrown into jail. And then the king comes back, and he says, why did you do this to me after I extended grace? And all of the disciples are supposed to go, boo! You know, who is that dirty, rotten guy? And Jesus turns it back and he says, that's exactly what you're like when God has forgiven you and you refuse to give someone else. You're the one that owed $5 million, and now you're going to make a big deal about the $5 this other person owes you? And friends, I tell you, I am never at a place where I want to forgive until I remember how much Jesus has forgiven me. It's so important that we always carry in our mind that we are the ones that need the most forgiveness. Years ago, when I moved here, it wasn't for no reason. I'd never forget the story. Molly and I got married about 6 months before we came here, and so we were freshly married, and we had a cute little duplex up in Bremerton, and she was unpacking the cups and nesting, and I came to her, and there was a big falling out amongst the staff at the church. And I honestly think that wrong was done to me. Not on purpose, but it was just politics. It was a very large staff, and there was some office politics and some power plays that went on. And I got the brunt of it because I was kind of at the bottom of the totem pole. And I remember going to Molly and saying, Molly, I said, I hate to tell you this, but I think we're supposed to move on. I think it's time. And I was there another few months. I reconciled with all of those people, so I didn't have anything undealt with, but I did know it was time, and so that's when we drove down here in November, just about this time of year. We drove down from Rainier down to the highway, and the leaves were falling, and we came down to St. Helens, and there were kids playing stickball in the streets where I had come from. In Bremerton, kids would come to the youth group with their arm in a sling because they got shot in a gang fight. I said, this is the kind of place I want to come. I just want to come down here and preach the gospel. But I knew this, that before I moved on, I wanted to settle those things in my heart. And so I can honestly say when I went down here, it was just a breath of fresh air, just starting over. And it was such a wonderful time. That next year, within about a year, one of my friends from up on in that church got married and had me come up was I the preacher or the best man? Can't remember. It was one of them. And I went up there, and the pastor knew I was in town and invited me over to his house and sat me down. And I love this pastor. I still do. He sat me down in his living room, and he says, Mike, I just want to tell you what happened about a year ago. I've had a lot of time to think about it, and I really think you were wronged in that. I don't think you did anything wrong. I think we really didn't treat you right. And I want you to know I'm really sorry for it. And the amazing thing is, I could honestly look him back in my eye and I said, that's really kind of you to say, but I gave that up a long time ago. I said, I haven't been carrying any of it. If he had never apologized, it would have not been any big deal to me, because I determined in my mind not to carry that thing with me. And friends, I got to tell you how much freedom there is even before you get that apology. And like I said, there have been a couple times in my life where it happened like that. Don't you wish it happened like that every time? That everybody that's ever wronged you is going to sit you down and apologize? And the best part of it, that next Sunday, he asked me to preach in his church. So I think it's wonderful. Both of the churches that I served as youth pastors, after I was there, they had me come back and preach. And I left them with money in the bank and even found my replacement, hired my own youth pastor replacement. First one was Molly. She wasn't my wife back then. And the other one was Craig. And I think last I checked, he was still the youth pastor up there after all these years. And so, friends, I just got to tell you, one of the most important things, in fact, I say people think that the most important part of being a Christian is to be really religious, is to appear really holy, to make other people, not just to be holy, but to look holy, that other people think, oh, they're so holy. They don't do this and they don't do that. Look at how much time they spend at church and blah, they do all of these things. But as far as the Bible is concerned and as far as the Lord is concerned, the most important part is the relationship of it. This is why I never get it. People can get mad at somebody in the church or mad at the pastor. I get mad at the pastor. I go home all the time and I say, I can't believe you said that. That was a stupid thing to say. You know, Proverbs say, where words are many, sin is not absent. Try preaching every Sunday. If you were up here every Sunday, you would say dumb stuff too. You would. And I'd be sitting down there getting offended and heckling you. I can't believe they said that up there from the Pope. They think they're the pastor. People get mad about the silliest things, and then they think, well, I guess we got to find another church. And I said, ah, man, I never get that. I'm not the Pope. I'm not infallible. You can disagree with me. And what just surprises me all the time is how people feel like they've got to leave a church because they had a disagreement. And they forget that the most important thing we're doing here is relationship. Even more important than the topic I'm preaching about today is the relationship that we're having. Even more important than the songs we sang today is our fellowship together. Are you with me? It's more important than those things. And friends, thank goodness, if you had gotten divorced the first time you had an agreement, there would be no marriages left in this place. How many know that if you're going to be in a relationship, you've got to be able to forbear and to forgive, or none of it's going to happen? I remember that somebody asked an older woman how she had been married for 60 years. And she goes, because we got two stuffed bears in the entry of our house. And they have a name scrolled on the front. One of them is called Bear, and the other one's called Forbear. And it says that's the two secrets to being married for 60 years, is you've got a bear and you've got a forbear. And you've got to forgive. And so the last part, I've already been preaching the last point, by the way, is the power of reconciliation. And friends, no, I do not believe that reconciliation means you go and undo the past. Sometimes it just means extending a gesture of friendship. And I say it again, this is a hard sermon to preach, because just like Paul says, live at peace with everybody as far as it depends on you, reconciliation is not always possible, but it should be a priority. It should be our first option. It should be the thing that we work at, even when everything else doesn't go right. He says, do not fear. And then Joseph turned to him and he says, I will provide for you and your children. By the way, this is Hezekiah in the southern kingdom reassuring all the northern tribes that they were going to be taken care of, even though they used to be enemies. And then he said, and then he comforted them, and then he spoke to their hearts. The last thing he did was to reassure them and just to reach out relationally. Said, all right, let's leave it behind. You've already said you're sorry. But now the last thing is I want to restore something in your heart. I said forgiveness, first and foremost, is a blessing because it sets us free. But there's another aspect to it too, friends, is sometimes we need to realize how much power we have to make a difference in someone's life by extending grace to them. By extending grace. Not because they've earned it or deserved it, but you can really bring about healing in somebody's life. It's so important. I know Molly and I throughout the years with our kids, whenever we have a clash or a battle or wherever they get, they have to have consequences or, you know, because we care about their character and want them to be successful. Sometimes we confront. That's what loving parents do, right? And I think it's so important that when that consequence is over, that there be some kind of restoration. That there be a moment of, I love you, I care about you, and restoration of that relationship. That just because there's consequence doesn't mean the relationship is over. Friends, I had to tell you, this is so important. I can't tell you, every single one of our kids at some point or another heard Molly and I arguing about somebody because, I don't know if you know this, she's kind of stubborn. Tenacious. I only say that because so am I. If you've got two people in your marriage, you're going to have disagreements if you have two different brains in your head. Are you with me? And so I used to think when I was a younger parent, the first rule is never, ever, ever disagree in front of your children. I said, I don't know if that's exactly healthy. Because at one point, some of our kids would come up to you, Dad, are you and Mom getting divorced? Because they've seen that happen to a lot of their parents, a lot of their friends' parents. And I said, honey, no, why would you think that? We were just arguing about what show to watch. Or who's going to be in charge of the remote control. We're not getting divorced over that. And I think it's important for kids to realize that just because you have a disagreement doesn't mean you have to end the relationship. Isn't that something? It's important for them to see Mom and Dad, even at times, have a disagreement and then reconcile and love each other. Say, no, even people that love. I said this to one of my brothers. I said, doesn't your sister ever really tick you off? He goes, yes. And I said, well, do you want to get rid of her? He goes, no. I said, well, that's the way Mom and I are. there are sometimes just like a brother and sister, and she tells me that all the time, that I act more like a little brother than a husband sometimes. And only sometimes. And I said, just like you're brother and sister, and you're always going to be brother and sister, Mom and I are going to be married till the day we die. And I said, but every once in a while, we don't see eye to eye. And that's okay. Reconciliation puts the relationship here and puts being right down here. You remember this? Great cliche, and I didn't make it up. Remember, Jesus died on the cross when he was right and everybody else was wrong. And he forgave us once and for all. The Apostle Paul writes to the Corinthian church. He writes two letters to them. The first one, I think it's chapter 5, he corrects them. He rebukes them in love as a pastor. He had pastored there. And there was a young man in sin in their congregation, and they weren't even doing anything about it. Corinth, the city of Corinth, was a very vile and immoral place. And so even the word Corinth was a dirty word back in the ancient world. And so he's telling the church, he goes, you're acting just like the world. You need to deal with this sin. You know, you need to really, let this young man know that he's not doing the right thing. The second letter he writes is in response to how they handled it. And he reminds him. He goes, okay, you've done a good job. You've dealt with it now. But now you need to restore him. Because as of yet, they hadn't restored him yet. And he says this in 2 Corinthians 6:8. He says, the punishment inflicted on him by the majority is sufficient. That means the shame that he already feels, because you've addressed it, whatever, he already feels bad. Now instead, you ought to forgive and comfort him so that he will not be overwhelmed by excessive sorrow. I urge you, therefore, to reaffirm your love for him. Isn't that wisdom? He says, listen, there is a point in time that we as brothers and sisters need to confront one another, hold each other accountable. That's a healthy family does that, to hold each other accountable. And there is a point in time that we need to be able to restore somebody so that their shame doesn't destroy them. And we need to know where that healthy balance is. Anybody with me so far? There's such wisdom in this story. I just can't even, I probably didn't make it any better, but at least I just wanted to talk about the importance of this restoration in our life. And it was 700 years before Jesus, but Jesus was the pinnacle of it. To die for us on the cross, and one of the last things he said is, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. He forgave them, and he set us all free. And now he's given us the power of reconciliation. Paul calls it the ministry of reconciliation. He's given that power to set other people free when they need it, to be a part of their healing and their restoration. Amen. You ever watch the show This Is Us? It's a very popular show. I've seen it a couple times. It's kind of a dramatic story about people with imperfect lives and going about their business and dealing with their conflicts and stuff. And I watched a couple episodes. I said, I don't need to watch that show. I'm living that show. I said, I don't need more drama in my life, please. I need more entertainment. But anyway, on the pilot episode is one of my favorite scenes. And it's of a young businessman that finally goes and locates and finds and meets his biological father. I don't think it needs much more explanation other than just to say, you know, I always edit these things. So if I show a movie clip and there's coarse language, this one is made for TV, so there's not like really profanity in it, but there was some unkind language that I bleeped out. So anyways, it is rated G, but it's a powerful scene. Just watch this for a moment.
Hey, clear my afternoon?
Sir,
thanks.
Stop all that banging. I heard you the first time banging on the door.
My name is Randall Pearson. I'm your biological son.
36 years ago, you left me at the front door. But now, hold on. Just let me say this. 36 years ago, you left me at the front door of a fire station. Now, don't worry. I'm not here because I want anything from you. I was raised by two incredible parents. I have a lights-out family of my own. And that car you see parked out in front of your house cost $143,000, and I bought it for cash. I bought it for cash because I felt like it and because I can do stuff like that. Yeah. You see, I turned out pretty all right, which might surprise a lot of folks considering the fact that 36 years ago, my life started with you leaving me on a fire station doorstep with nothing more than a ratty blanket and a filled diaper. I came here today so I could look you in the eye, say that to you, and then get back in my fancy car and finally prove to myself and to you and to my family who loves me that I didn't need a thing from you, even after I knew who you were.
You want to come in?
Okay. So is this something you want to say to me? Because otherwise, I really need to get going.
You want me to say something?
I told you, I don't want anything from you.
But you're here.
Just to tell you that.
Well, I've been told.
You know what? If you're just going to sit here making excuses.
Then making excuses.
Because there's nothing you can say.
I didn't say anything for just that reason. Seems to me you want me to try to make amends so you can say something. You and storm out of here.
That's ridiculous.
Okay. I'd like to say I remember that day, but I barely do. I'm clean now, finally, but I was on the streets then. I remember her dying. Your mom. Remember the baby? I'd like to say I remember leaving you at a fire station, but I don't. Not an excuse. In fact, it probably tells you something.